Welcome. This is Lori with NBC Academy. Just a little bit about Mickey. She is a co-founder of the Bay Area NVC. We know it as Bay NVC. And the lead collaboration consultant at the Center for Efficient Collaboration. Mickey aims to support visionary leadership in shape of a livable future using collaborative tools based on the principles of nonviolent communication. She shares these tools through meeting facilitation, mediation, consulting, coaching, and training for organizations and committed individuals. Her latest book, Reweaving Our Human Fabric, Working Together to Create a Nonviolent Future, published in 2015, explores the practices and systems needed for a collaborative society. She is also the author of Spinning Threads of Radical Aliveness, Transcending the Legacy of Separation in Our Individual Lives, and The Little Book of Courageous Living. Mickey blogs at The Fearless Heart, and her articles have appeared in the New York Times, Tikkun, Waging Nonviolence, Shareable, Peace and Conflict, and elsewhere. She holds a PhD in sociology from UC Berkeley. With that, I would like to just hand it over to you. I'm so excited for our first session of Working for Transformation Without Recreating the Past.
Thank you, Lori. I am really and truly excited. It feels like I've been preparing for this for about 20 years, so it's a big moment for me, and I'm grateful for it happening and for all the amazing amount of work that went into making this possible. I think there are plenty of people here who have not been with me before in classes, so let me just say that I tend to be highly interactive. Lecturing is not my favorite medium, so I like to ask questions, to answer questions, to engage with people as we learn. So for starters, I want to ask, first of all, a few questions just to get to have a general sense of you. How many of you consider yourself actively involved in creating change in the world in one form or another, beyond your own immediate personal life? That is very cool. There are 41 of you and 35 have said yes. That's really cool because that was my hope, that I will be here met with people who are actively engaged in this way. My foundation is nonviolent communication. This is not a class in nonviolent communication. It is a class that uses the principles of nonviolence and specifically also of nonviolent communication, which is my own flavor of nonviolence. So there's no requirement that anybody knows this, and it's not what we're going to be focusing on primarily. I usually like to have an agreement with people who have no previous experience in nonviolent communication. I would like to ask you, if you see me talk in a way that sounds to you like jargon, which can happen, it's not my intention and I'm very conscious of it. I think that using jargon limits the possibility of certain principles and ways of being in the world from attracting more people and being more widespread because we sound like a cult sometimes. So if that happens, I would love it if you would raise your hand and let me know that you don't understand what I'm saying, that it's not making sense to you. So this is the agreement. And now I would like to hear from individuals, anyone who wants to tell me, what's your biggest hope for what this course will give you? How do you imagine that you will benefit from being here?
My biggest hope, well, my ultimate hope is to be of benefit to the world. My biggest personal hope is to develop my leadership skills so that I actually can help grow our organization and our work as it's now moving across the world. The big project is Cities of Peace. Mm-hmm. It's collaborative participatory work honoring world cities that are traumatized by war. It's honoring the history and culture of world cities. And we do it through a three-part platform. We work to create an original painting that's filled with the history and culture of each city we honor. It's to inspire hope, and it does not show violence. The second part is exhibition of all the cities we've created. And the third is program and policy, how to use Cities of Peace as a tool for peace education and for architecting a new cultural diplomacy. That's the work.
Thank you. And back to you. Can you think of what it is that you want to be able to do more effectively as a leader? What's the challenge you're facing where you're not right now all the way to where you want to be?
It's communication with MP, members of parliament, with mm-hmm. governments, with funders. It's a high-level knowledge of appropriate yeah. communication skills, proper decorum, and at the same time, combining diplomatic knowledge with a spiritual base so that it's always connected to the principles that guide the work. So communication yeah. is primary for me, and knowledge.
Yeah. One of the challenges that I see in the arena of communication, it has to do with communicating with people who are not already aligned with your vision or your method, either one, and how to do it in a way that maintains full integrity with what you know, what you see, what you envision, what you believe in, what you're committed to, full integrity with that, while at the same time meeting people where they are. One of the things that I see a lot in social movements is a way of writing off people who are not in agreement. That is one of the things that I think, again, is keeping us from being effective. I have complete understanding where the temptation is coming from, but that's one of the things that I'm hoping we will get to in this course.
May I say one more thing?
Absolutely.
I'm actually writing to MPs, members of parliament, and in different countries who are already on my team. And the
yeah.
question is how to push without being a pushy American, how to grow and
yeah. uh-huh.
actually develop the program so that we can actually implement it. They already want it. It's a question
yeah.
of how to interact to carry it to the next levels of realization.
Yeah. To bring it a little bit to the theme of today, change doesn't happen only because somebody believes that it's a good idea. There are several aspects to change, and one of them is a kind of internal shift, and internal can be internal within an individual or internal within a group, that leads to the willingness to take action, to take decisive action. And that's one of the things that I want us to look at later. So thank you and welcome. What is bringing you here? What's your hope?
I'm a social entrepreneur, and for the last few years I've been working in different organizations, but now I'm trying to distill the insights that I've learned from that and create a new organization, sort of an innovation consultancy that works with communities to solve the problems that they have. So where I'm struggling is that I don't know how to create the structures and then starting from scratch, the structures and processes which are embedded in my personal values. Mm-hmm. What I'm hoping to get out of this is to learn how to solidify, get a deeper understanding of what are my own values, and then also apply them into the way I'm building this company.
Thank you. So what you are looking for is most likely to be covered in the third part of the course, because essentially the way that this course is organized, the first 4 weeks are kind of a really condensed, intensive to what nonviolence means and how we orient ourselves towards nonviolent social change. Some of what you want will happen in the second part too, but the second part is about how we relate to other people and how we begin to form groups and organizations that function in a way that expresses the vision. That's the piece about not recreating the past. This is why Gandhi and Martin Luther King were so adamant about this very little equation, the means equal the ends. And that's why I want to start from really getting deep into what it means to do all this work nonviolently. And then the last part is how to organize campaigns and think about the larger systemic questions. Thank you.
I work with NVC. I coach people and I lead practice groups and workshops. I am really wanting to be working with some of the social change organizations and groups in this area and help them figure out how they can be working within the community in a different way, with compassion and with peace rather than violence, and promoting communication, compassionate communication and connection. I'm here with this because I want to learn how to support them, how to bring this to organizations so that they can bring it into the community, and how to support my community. And I'm here because working in this area with nonviolent communication has just become a very spiritual, meaningful practice for me. And I'm looking for support and connection throughout the world and throughout my country and my community. And in every way, I want to be connected and a part of this.
One of the paradoxes is that people who are already working to create social change or to do community organizing or any of these kinds of things, they don't have time to learn communication. They're too busy doing the work. So if we want to bring these tools to people who are so active, it requires us to embed the principles that are dear to us in structures, in processes, in agreement, in frames, rather than make it be a communication practice. A lot of NVC people are challenged to make that transformation. So hopefully being here will help with that too. What is bringing you here? What's your hope?
I am leading a community collaborative called the Restorative Community Network. And it's a group of individuals and service providers who are working towards bringing practices of restorative approaches together. So rather than working as individual programs in silo function, to advocate for cross-organizational collaborations and working towards policy and systems change to allow for a more healing and transformative process for juvenile offenders. The reason I'm really excited about this course is because it has occurred to me that in our process, we seem to be recreating the same that's currently existing in the bureaucratic structure. We have, as part of our prioritize action items, community and relationship building among service providers, but I also want to keep the dialogue open of, you know, is this simply a different form of what currently exists, or are we really creating a systems change? I just want to make sure that I can offer this information in a way that's receivable, you know, because we're working with district attorneys and probation officers. You know, it's heart talk versus head talk.
Yeah, so the dilemma that you are articulating is one of the core reasons why I'm doing this course. Fundamentally, the dilemma that we are so many generations, most of us, there are still cultures that retain the original evolutionary collaborative functioning. They still exist. They're dying, but they still exist. But most of us, especially in the industrialized world, are many, many, many generations out of that way of functioning. So we don't have someone to look to learn the model. It is on us to excavate the collaborative, nonviolent possibility, the connected, common good possibility, to excavate it out of the ruins of the world of separation, scarcity, and powerlessness. While we ourselves are traumatized by that world and have internalized it, it is a task of such magnitude that I'm hoping that my framing it is giving you some sense of that kind of like small relief of being understood. Tell me if that is so.
Absolutely. I call it the Salvador paradox. That which we're trying to deconstruct is what's holding us back from achieving our goal.
Yes. And so for me, in order to change this dynamic, that is part of why Gandhi always said that personal practice is the core of everything. It isn't a substitute for doing the systemic work that you're trying to do or the organizational work. There are many people who take a quote that is attributed to Gandhi but actually isn't something that he said. And that is the line that says, be the change you want to see in the world. That quote is attributed to Gandhi. He never said it. And people take that. I mean, it is consistent with things that he said, but it is only partial to kind of like reduce social change to the idea that enough of us just need to live in a way that's consistent with the world we want to create. If we just do that, we won't get to the world we want to create, because we will just be a collection of individuals. And there are a variety of reasons why that approach cannot succeed. Technically, it is true. If a critical mass of people adopted radical critical response to what is happening in the world, things could not continue, would not be able to continue. There is no power in the world that is strong enough to maintain all of us in disempowered positions without our having internalized that the way things are is the only way that they could be. So we are not creating enough of an obstacle for the people who think they benefit from what is happening to have to contend with. And so we have internalized it. And that makes it very difficult for each person to create change when the system outside and the internalized voices inside persist in a particular direction. Only people with unusual strength or unusual amount of support or unusual vision are able to do something that goes against the grain under such conditions. And to expect that a critical mass can do it is unlikely. So that kind of like a big reason. And so the internal work on cleaning our consciousness, and I personally do it through the linguistic lens, but it's not the only possible practice. But I'll tell you the practice that I do. I watch my language to see where I use words or conceptual frames that reproduce the existing order. Am I making sense to you so far?
Absolutely, yeah.
So, for example, the word should is a word that I have pretty much transformed out of my language. Why did I want to do that? Because the word should achieves a number of things. One is, it is almost guaranteed to kill joy. Think about it. If you tell yourself that you should do something, what's the likelihood that you will have joy in doing it? For me, it's pretty much zero. On a deeper level, the word should takes the question of where does authority come from and puts it outside of me. So it is disempowering to say I should do something or you should do something. It doesn't really matter whether it's I or someone else or the government. As soon as I say should, the source of authority is external. It's either God or institutions or whoever happens to be in power or someone else who is in authority but not me, or some collective unclear source of authority. If I continue in that vein, I don't develop my own inner strength to make my choices based on my values. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about this and how it applies, this particular kind of practice. Do you understand what I'm trying to do? And just any reflections, I would love to hear from you.
Yeah, we're trying to use something similar, not necessarily with words or the language, but the essence. So what's a practice that we're using? Even when we talk about who is a member of this collaborative, ensuring that we don't recreate a punitive, if you don't show up for so many meetings, then you're not considered a member. Trying to come up with terms instead of the executive planning team restorative name.
Yeah. So you're trying to institute practices that go against what is happening, the models of power, of leadership, of functioning that we have inherited. And I applaud that. And it's hard work if it isn't also worked on at the individual level as much as possible for those who are really trying to create the change.
Sure. And just the struggle lives deep within me. How to be a leader without being a controller. I have my own complex around leadership.
Yes, you and all of us. And here's the dilemma. For as long as the word leadership is filtered through our traumatic experiences of what it has meant, it is going to be really difficult to find the strength and the vision and the imagination to embody a different kind of leadership. Instead, what many do, and I don't know you, many people shy away from leadership as a way to not be oppressive. But then what ends up happening is we leave positions of leadership for the people who are willing to use their power over other people, recreating in that way what we want. I really want a massive migration of people with revolutionary, transformed awareness or vision to step into positions of leadership so that we can show and create the models. So this is a fantastic responsibility for you, and I hope that over the course of these coming weeks, it will lead you in the direction of being the visionary that you want to be. Okay, a couple more people.
So I won't say what I want to gain. I think I'll just describe my context because I didn't hear it described before. I work with a entity known as the Emancipation Economic Development Council, which was created to address the displacement of African-American modest and low-income residents in a neighborhood that has historically been their neighborhood, which we describe that phenomenon as gentrification. And we are faith-based organizations, businesses, nonprofits, and even government entities with very few residents currently in our coalition. We work with, have collaborations with large institutions like MIT and other universities and now even professional planners. And so the struggle is being able to maintain a very community-led group and also to be able to integrate into that group more structurally vulnerable residents in the neighborhood and hold a place of equity with them. At the same time, holding a place of equity with funders and city leaders and Bloomberg consultants. And so it's a lot of different structural positions that in this environment. And being able to work around housing and employment and these large issues in a way that, as
what is similar, what you said and everybody else said, without recreating the same systems that we're struggling against.
Just taking a breath to just take all that in, because you're clearly on the front lines of a form of oppression that is structural and remains invisible to a lot of people. So I just want to just acknowledge you first and express gratitude that you're choosing to take time away from that immense work to be here, and humbly hope that I will have something to offer you. I have a friend, Victor Lewis, has been a social justice educator for years, and he has given me an image that I carry with me everywhere. And the image is a way to, well, let me first tell you what the image is and then explain why it is so meaningful to me. The image is we're all in the same boat, not on the same deck. Wondering if it's resonant for you.
Yes, it does. I love that. We're all, and I'm going to maybe use that in the group with your permission. We're all in the same boat, but not on the same deck. Yeah, that's right. A beautiful way to represent it.
Yeah, and he grew up in the projects in Cleveland, so he comes from that kind of like deep, visceral knowledge of what it means. But I want to unpack it, because what this image does is it brings together two truths that often remain separate from each other. One is that there is no separation. We really are all one. We are all part of a big oneness on the spiritual plane, and also even on the practical material plane. If this ship crashes, we all die. That's one reality. And a lot of people assert that reality in a way that ignores the structural discrepancies that exist in society. So the second reality is it's not affecting everyone in the same way. Some people, some groups, some communities have already sunk to a level of non-sustainability, non-survival. And so how to keep our eyes on both of these realities at the same time is, to me, for me, one of the tasks of our time if we want to create change in the world.
And I just wanted to add, I think, you know, if I can touch a spot of tenderness within myself, that, you know, there's been such trauma that African people have suffered in with other groups. And so, you know, there is a limited amount of trust and oftentimes a little limited amount of space for those experiences, and how do we hold peace, but also hold hope that we can do it differently and we can be different. So as a key organizer in the group, that I have to find a way to honor the history and hold space for it, but not allow it to dominate the possibility of what we can do in this moment. So that's my personal challenge, honoring my people and the people that I share that experience with, but also work to build a bridge to a new possibility for us all.
Got it. Okay. So I love the way you're saying this. And I want to say a couple of things. One is you and every single one of us that faces some traumatic reality, doesn't really matter what it is, but faces it regularly. We must have grieving and mourning be part of our ongoing life so that we don't harden inside, so that we can remain soft and vulnerable. And if you don't have support to do that, that is, to me, a critical practice, because you see too much and there's too much grief, and that grief cannot be allowed to accumulate inside of you. It needs to move. Am I making sense to you?
Yes, and thank you for that acknowledgement and that offering to me, because that it hits, you know, when you said that it connects to something that I don't often acknowledge or hold space for, but it is a truth that I recognize when you expressed it. Thank you.
So now, right in this second you're in touch with it, and you were just getting ready to skip over it and go to the next thing, weren't you?
Yes, the skipping. Yes, I'm good at the skipping.
Let's not skip. This is a form of leadership. When you have the willingness, with my support, to expose the immensity of pain, it's a form of leadership. Because if you skip, who will tell other people what's going on? I want you to sit with that for a moment and take a few breaths and imagine there are 50 people on the call, and imagine that all of them are holding this grief with you. Even if they don't know what it is, just by virtue of your willingness to speak it, I'm confident that a lot of people are now holding it with you, rooting for you to be able to hold it and keep going with hope and truth. Can you feel that?
Yes, I can.
So let's take a moment of silence and for you to just breathe fully so you can really take it in and let it water your cells. I can't see you, but I'm hoping that you actually are taking it in.
Thank you.
Will know mostly in your shoulders. If you feel your shoulders kind of like relaxing a little, that's a good signal. And I'm not done yet. There's two other things. One is, when you are in a position of leadership, and this is another thing that I'm quoting my friend Victor again, anyone who is a liberation leader, somehow we all need to take on the liberation of everyone. That is the strongest antidote to victimization. Is that resonating anywhere in you, or is it challenging to take in?
Can you repeat it for me?
Absolutely. You are a liberation leader. You are working to liberate both the material reality and the consciousness of communities that are traumatized and struggling and oppressed and structurally invisible. I'm reading that accurately.
Yeah.
In the way that I understood it from Victor, you can only be effective if you are committed in your heart to the liberation of all.
Yeah, that resonates with me, and it fits with me. It is universal. It is a universal principle that I stand on, and not context specific, but principle based.
Yeah.
Yes.
You put your effort into supporting the communities and the causes and the people that, in this mysterious way that we never know exactly why we're called to do this and not that, you are called in this particular way, so that's where your energy goes. But at the level of heart commitment, I always want to be committed to the liberation of all. And what that means to me is that you will need to have people who are not of those communities, who you trust, even if the communities don't trust them, that you personally do the work to make the full human contact with some people who are not of those communities, so that you have a way to be nourished from outside the struggle. Does that make sense?
That makes a lot of sense. The most sense, if I can just take a moment to share, my partner and I often say how our social time together is not, you know, with the people who I spend most of my time struggling with. And we always wonder so oddly, why is that the case? But I think without knowing it, that's why it's the case, because we need some nurturing for ourselves.
And then the last thing is, I mean, there will be more over the coming weeks, but in this moment, as I'm hearing you talk about the trauma that makes it hard for people to trust, what I hope can be done, and it's something you can do that I would never be able to do because I am not of that community, but I have you as a link, is to affirm and surround with tenderness the mistrust. A really clear understanding of why it would be there. It is so wrenchingly clear why the mistrust would be there, because of not only is it past trauma, but things are continuing to happen. The structural violence is not a thing of the past. It's happening here, today. So affirming that, giving people a place where they know they can be understood, while at the same time holding a challenging hand, inviting them into a more empowered position, both at once. That's what I hope, with enough strength and vision and nurturing, that you can do as a leader. Works?
Thank you. Yeah.
And I appreciate the immense risk that you took against whatever residue of mistrust you would have to speak all of this. I'm super grateful to you.
Thank you for those who raised their hands first to be vulnerable, first to show me that I could be vulnerable and still be okay.
That's one of the things I've learned. You don't need everybody to be vulnerable at once. You need one person who has the courage. If that person does it, then somebody who didn't have the courage, now they have a smaller bar to cross. By the third or fourth or fifth person, then there is an atmosphere of, this is a place where we can be vulnerable. Thank you. Okay. I am really happy with what has been happening and what we are opening up. And I want to have an opportunity for more people to engage both with what you heard and with your own experiences. So I'd like to divide you into pairs for just a few minutes. See, I think maybe there is a question.
It's a question of how we handle when we're on the line, feeling even more vulnerable or feeling having voices of self-criticism come up from the conversation. How do I handle just wanting to break down and weep over the years of extraordinary struggle and risk and challenge?
Personally, I'm biased. I don't believe that we can reach full liberation without crying buckets. So let yourself cry. When it comes, just let yourself cry. It's not a breaking down, it's a breaking open. And if you pair up with someone, then you can get support from each other along the way, not just right now.
Okay. If I still use the word director, I'm the artistic director, or I'm the visionary founder, are those disempowering labels that I'm using that cause harm to others?
There's no immediate and direct answer. I love it that you're grappling with the question, and I want you to keep grappling with the question. I can only say that in my mind, the issue is not about not having power. The issue is about how we use the power that we have, and we'll get to that along the way in the course. All right, and here is what I'd like you to do in the pair. Two things. One is just take a few minutes to just, like Ellen just expressed, like so many of us, when we face the reality of what is happening, it becomes difficult. That's one thing. Just take maybe 2 minutes each way. We'll start with 2 minutes each way to just speak and express whatever is living in you. And then take some time to share with each other where it is that you want to see change within yourself and around you in the direction that you want to create, and just share that with each other a little bit. What gives you hope? What are the challenges? And then when we come back, we will continue the conversation about that relationship between personal change and social change, and what makes change difficult, possible, the topics that we have for our time today. All right, so I'm hoping to cover a few of the themes that we haven't touched on yet. So let's see what you're bringing with you. And if you want to step forward with something from your conversation that you want to explore.
My experience during this breakout with my partners was really powerful for me. There was a tremendous amount of empathy and synergy in our stories across a significant generation. So Sue is in her 70s and I'm in my 30s. And there was an extraordinary amount of just synchronicity about different things we're working with in our life processes on personal and professional or working community levels. And there was a part of me initially that was like, ooh, I have another friend who's on the call. We're going to talk anyway. Ah, I don't know if I'll do this partner thing. And I just feel like I feel very euphoric on taking the risk, going ahead and pressing that number, and just filled with a lot of gratitude for that even brief connection. And one of the things that we stumbled upon that I thought was really powerful is the need for cross-generational connection and collaboration, and that it's not just something we're going back to. It's not just trying to reproduce a tradition of eldership that we've lost or something that used to be, but it's actually moving into cross-generational and intergenerational relationship in a new way that is deeply necessary for meeting the unique challenges of this moment. So that was something powerful I wanted to share.
Can you say, how do you see it being specifically necessary?
For me, and it's something that Jonathan Rosenthal, who works with the New Economy Coalition, taught me many years ago around there are different ways that we have of seeing in terms of the generation we were raised in terms of our life moments, and there's also tremendous synchronicity. And the society that I live in tends to encourage people to self-isolate across generational lines, as opposed to engage with a different kind of humility that supports putting those different ways of seeing together in one sort of pot, if you will, to meet a particular challenge in the moment in community. And the complexity of our challenges of this moment, the depth of pain and grief that we need to work with and process, I think there's a unique kind of healing that can happen when people across generations connect with each other in a way that can hold pain and sorrow and also reinvigorate joy and hope, both in people of older generations in sort of re-enlivening their faith in the pain that they've experienced, and younger generations in being able to say, wow, uncertainty is really here. And there's a lot of people out there who have lived through a lot. And I'm going to do my best while I'm here to keep engaging.
Thank you. I want to say that I'm appreciating that you're bringing up this perspective. And for me, it looks like age is only one dimension. We live in times when everything around us encourages us to relate only to what is similar to us. I don't know how many people know it. If you go to Google and type something to search for something, and I go to Google and type something to search for it, we will not get the same result because our behavior is tracked. So we get a tunnel vision of being faced with only that which caters to what we are already exposed to. This is before we even begin the work of change. It starts in school. It's a very modern phenomenon for children, first of all, to go to school at all, period. But even more than that, to go to school and spend hours every day only with children who are their same age. It's not natural for humans. It's not how we evolved. And then you add class segregation, race segregation, national segregation, religious segregation, all of these things. So we end up relating primarily to people who are similar to us. And the piece that I'm getting from what you're saying is if we're going to create change, we will need to relate to people who are different from us, both because it will be necessary for multiple types of people to work together to create change, or else the change won't happen, and also because we are in such a difficult place that we need the synergy of collective wisdom that comes from exposing ourselves to multiple perspectives, which is the piece that you brought forth. Thank you for that.
Yeah.
I really appreciate it. Thank you.
I'm super grateful for the opportunity to connect. And I think it's not just connecting to people who have different perspectives than us. There's also that element of surrounding ourselves with people we feel a kinship with in terms of on a spiritual kind of emotional friend. That nourishment is important even as we try to connect across difference.
Thank you. Yes, one of the reasons for this need for spiritual connection, I'm speaking to everyone again and inviting other topics to come to the foreground. I really thrive on engaging with people. I will speak about other topics if no one comes forward, but I really would love it if people did. I want to speak to this for a moment, that to create the kind of transformation that we need to create as individuals and within groups, we can't do it individually. We need to have community. We need to have people who do see the world like us that we can lean on for a while to give us strength to continue, because anytime you stand up to business as usual, you create more friction and more challenge in your life, and we need that kind of support. All right, let's see.
One of the things that came up for me even this week before the class started that I was excited, so I'm a leader in a number of organizations, both informally and formally, depending on where I am. I feel like I keep bumping into this internalized competition and sense of scarcity that I dislike and then get a lot of like shame about feeling. I feel like I keep like trying to dig it out and it just pops up over and over. And so I know that it must be blocking having more transformation both internally and in the organizations that I'm working with and around. So I don't have any other thoughts. I'm just leaving it open and hoping for anything.
I want to engage with you because I think what you're bringing is exactly pointing to the piece that I wanted to look at, which is the interplay between the personal and the structural. So I'll give you an example that is a little bit different from what you're talking about, but I'll get to what you're talking about. Trust me. Talking with someone earlier this week, she told me a story that some version of it I'd heard before. She had had a corporate career in which she was successful. She had kind of like an internal dead end within it, which she could stay there and she was making a lot of money and all of the telltale signs of success in that world. But it wasn't working for her and it was actually making her sick. So she ended up leaving and now has been struggling for several years to figure out what to do instead. How to live a life that is meaningful and sustainable. And I'm sure you've heard this kind of story before, right? It's a kind of an archetypal story of our time. Suddenly it hit me that what this story illustrates, amongst many things, is the fallacy of looking for individual solutions to systemic problems. The issue is not with her. The issue is with the structure of work. What it does is if you are even mildly sensitive, you reach a place where you, if you're in a corporate world, and I'll make it a little bit dramatic, where you need to choose between spiritual suicide and financial suicide. Most people choose the spiritual suicide because they have families and children and mortgage and those kinds of things, and it's too scary. Then what will you do instead? So you can be a trainer, a coach, a facilitator, a massage therapist. You know, there's like a long list of what people are trying to do. And we end up creating a culture in which we coach each other, but none of us are actually producing or generating something that sustains life. I'm not criticizing. I'm in that line of business myself. But there's some way that we don't know how to find meaning in life and be materially productive. And we look for personal solution, but the problem is the structure of work. Similarly, how that relates to what you're talking about. In a world that is organized around command and control, competition, separation, scarcity, for any of us to act differently requires spiritual fortitude. We must become saints. And it's not a viable path to social change to expect of more and more individuals to become saints. So the first thing that happens when you realize that is you can start having tenderness for yourself. You can breathe and realize that you are affected by social structures, both directly and indirectly. Directly, because, you know, if you want to buy sustainable products and you live in a small town in the middle of the U.S., you just can't. It's not available. You have to be rich and order it on a plane to come from some other place, and then it's not sustainable because it's on a plane. You can't solve that individually. The structures constrain our abilities. Also indirectly, because it filters into us through socialization, which rests on shaming. And so you end up questioning yourself instead of the structure when there's an issue. Moving in the direction of collaboration, in the direction of embracing a radically new perspective on how to do life, requires us to be willing to step in the direction of where shame tells us not to go. I just read a quote, I'm not going to remember it. You know, the people who are trying to live a gift economy, they don't, I would say we, because I'm one of those people, I aim in that direction. We don't make it on the economic plane relative to the people who are in the competition paradigm. Those who are deeply rooted in that paradigm, and sometimes it's internalized within us, will see us as a failure. We are failing, we are losing. Whereas we see ourselves as not even competing. We live in a different paradigm. But when the dominant paradigm goes in a particular way, it's extremely difficult to maintain the strength. Wondering if this is helpful to you.
Super helpful, especially, well, there were a few things that were helpful. That last part, I think, really resonated. Yeah, this notion that when you're doing something that's not the same as the dominant culture and they're telling you to go in a different way, it's so uncomfortable in this way that I'm not always naming, and also just feeling a bit more compassion for myself around it.
Yeah, it is essential compassion towards self.
Yeah, it was helpful to hear about a reminder about walking towards where shame tells us not to go. Thank you.
Okay, let's see.
I'm really excited because this has been happening to me for about a year now, but more frequently lately, is that I've been running into people who have a similar goal or a similar type of activism that they are interested in. The perspective of the possibility of the exchange of ideas across the world, basically, is just really exciting to me. And knowing that there will be room for conversation in which we are both actively listening to each other is just so not like the culture, the dominant culture. I'm starved for it.
Great.
Hi. A lot of what you say kind of resonates with me on the kind of an theoretical, analytical level. The thing you just said a few minutes ago about problems of looking for individual solutions to systemic problems is something I've been thinking about and writing about my academic work for a long time. My struggle has been to try to become more effective in communicating with other people about some of these issues. And I'm not involved in any activist organizations right now, although I have been on and off for my whole life. But I do a lot of work, interaction with both political activists on the one hand, especially people connected in some way with anarchist politics or Occupy type groups, and also increasingly over the last few years with people in personal growth groups, not just thanks to NBC, but other groups like Network for New Culture and Human Awareness Institute. And the reason I'm in this class now is because I'm looking for ways of trying to integrate both sides of that. That in talking with activists, particularly who have more radical political perspectives, a lot of people in that group are not oriented toward learning how to be more compassionate or having empathy or talking about feelings. And for them, they're both busy with what they're doing, and it strikes them as a distraction from doing the work. You see their eyes roll if you talk about that. And in the personal growth world, I see people who are very much focused on themselves, doing what you said before Gandhi didn't say about be the change you want to be, you know, and their perspective on social changes, they just work on themselves. What I'm hoping to get out of these 12 weeks is more effective ways of communicating with both sides of that in ways that don't just turn people off.
Yeah. First of all, I want to say that I learned something very wise from my mother. She told me at a certain point when I was complaining about how some group was doing its change work, she said to me, we don't actually know what is going to bring about change. We don't know. We have our theories, but we don't know. For as long as what people are doing is not harmful, let's embrace it all. That was hugely helpful to me. Then I want to ask myself, why do I want to get the anarchists to do something different? And why do I want to get the people who are doing work on themselves to do something different? It's not like I don't want to. I do. I'm very opinionated. But I'm trying to cultivate humility. And where the kind of like the end point of that, when I'm able to reach it, is to recognize that I want to find a road that the anarchist and I can both walk on together, at least partway. It may not be the whole field that each of us covers. If I'm trying to change them, I'm not really aligned with my deep practice. If I'm trying to change the people who are doing only personal growth, I'm not deeply aligned with my perspective. I want to come to the dialogue with an intention to be as open to be changed by it as I want the other person to be open to me. And we'll get more into this in the next segment, starting with week 5. For now, mm-hmm. I just want to leave you with this and hear the next person that has a hand up. Is that okay?
Yeah, that's fine. Thank you. Very, very useful.
Uh-huh. Thanks.
I have a question about the structures and the status quo of the system. I guess it's very nuanced since, or it must be, but I participate in it by experiencing shame for my vulnerability. My question is, how do I start to become aware of perhaps unconscious buying into the system that causes me to feel shame?
I love the question, and I want to give you and everyone else a practice if you want to try it. And that practice is at the end of each day or at the beginning of the day, whenever it is a good time for you to sit down for a few minutes with yourself. Review the day and just review your actions and see what actions you might have taken based not on your own values, but based on fear or shame. Then the next piece is imagine like a fairy or your best friend or a dog that you had as a child that you loved or something that connotes love and tenderness. Imagine that surrounding your shame and you with tenderness. So you can, you know, at least protect yourself from having shame about having shame, if that makes sense. So that that piece can calm down and relax. Then imagine what you would have done instead. If you were able in that moment to overcome your shame, to walk towards it and do a different action, what would that different action be? And imagine yourself doing it. Sometimes, not in all instances, but sometimes you can go back and redo things. Sometimes you can go to a person and say, you know, yesterday I said this and this and this at a meeting, and I want you to know I said that because I was full of shame, but it wasn't really true of me. Here's what was true. Sometimes you cannot go back and redo the action, but you can integrate still the different possibility into your brain cells, especially if you write it or say it out loud. You do this every day. After a while, you will become more aware of how shame runs you and have a little bit more wiggle room to change it. How's that?
That sounds good.
So now it's time to close. And the way I like to close is I like to hear from a couple of people snippet of what you're taking with you from today. And so if you got something concrete, specific from today that you want to
I love that piece a few minutes ago about going against the system that we've been ingrained in and how hard it can be to do what many people tell us is a failure. I'm just sensing the enormous support of being with all these rich individuals and you on this course.
Thank you.
Thanks, Vicki. I heard you say to seek support as a leader. I will take that with me. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, for me, just acknowledging gratitude and also the idea that it's not about having to choose one or the other, that both change for self and change at this wonderful scale is possible. Thank you.
And you get the final word for today.
Being committed to the liberation of all.
Thank you. Okay.